This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to Tech Talk, and my name is Jeff Sandu, and this is part two of our Decade in Review special. But let me share you some stats. Grab, $14 billion. Twitter, $23 billion. Airbnb, $38 billion. Uber, $53 billion. And Didi, $56 billion. And Facebook, before they went on for IPO in 2012, $104 billion. That's how much tech companies are valued over the last decade. And if we dig deeper into how much has been spent on acquiring tech companies over the same decade, the numbers are just insane. For example, Microsoft bought Skype in 2011 for $8.5 billion, or Google acquired Motorola Mobility in the same year for $12.5 billion. Facebook added Instagram for $1 billion in 2012, and then WhatsApp for $19 billion in 2014 in their shopping cart. IBM acquired Red Hat for $34 billion in 2018, and Dell's acquisition of EMC for $67 billion is the record so far. Welcome to part two of our Decade in Review special. My name is Jeff Sandu, and on the phone with me today to take a look at why over the last decade the valuations and the money poured into tech startups have skyrocketed, and what makes a tech company so valuable in the last 10 years is Tariq Dennison. He's an Hong Kong based wealth manager at GFM Asset Management and the author of Invest Outside the Box. Tariq, it's a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
And perhaps you could refresh our memory a little bit on how 2010 felt like. Were we sort of seeing this kind of explosions? Were we ready for the explosive startups valuations and, you know, how they were going to be valued, and just how much of tech acquisitions were going to cost? Were there hints of things like this was going to happen?
Well, I remember 2010 quite well. I also remember 2000 quite well. In 2010, nobody was talking about massive tech valuations. Nobody was talking about startups being a huge growth sector. At that time, we were all still reeling from the 2008-2009 global financial crisis. Everyone was talking about credit. Everyone was talking about quantitative easing, when the economies were going to be out of the woods, and when we would start seeing growth again in any sector. So if anything, it was definitely not obvious in 2010. But what we've seen now is the full blossoming of what were some of the very earliest green shoots of the time, where areas that had started seeing growth or started showing areas of change had been showing growth over the past decade.
What was the catalyst that really drove for these kind of numbers to exist?
Well, there were several catalysts. It was no one thing. The biggest one, which I don't think many focusing on tech valuation pay as much attention to, is the Fed. Namely, the fact that we've had very low interest rates and very low rates of return on almost all other assets. What that meant is that we now have large amounts of capital unhappy with the rates of return we get on, say, property or bonds, needing to find other sources of return and other sources of growth. So in many ways, you can think of it as a supply-side problem with too much capital chasing too few new good ideas.
Mm-hmm. Why technology, though? What was so enticing about the tech sector in the last decade? Because it's something that we've seen in the previous decade about, you know, when it comes to the boom of the dot-com boom. But why over this last decade, technology sectors is just so, I guess, you know, enticing, and VCs, angel investors, they're all looking at tech startups?
Well, I wouldn't say it's just in the past decade, and I don't think comparing it to the dot-com boom is necessarily the fairest thing. If you look at technology really over the past 200 years, since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, what is appealing about it is the fact that it scales. So if you can take almost any other industry, if you invest in property, to double your rental income, you need to buy twice as much property. If you operate a hair salon, in order to make twice as much money, you need to cut twice as much hair. But the nice thing about technology is you can come up with a good piece of software. and you can serve 2 times, 20 times, 200 times as many customers with almost minimal incremental cost. And what that means is a very high margins, very high return on asset rates, and that's what makes it very, very appealing from an investor point of view. Now, if you wanted to compare it to earlier technologies, like let's say the railroad, when railroads first started listing, they were the hot tech sector that everybody wanted to have a part of. And of course, many of them went bust. These railroad companies raised lots of money in order to build lots of rail lines. Some of them were profitable. Many of them were not. And it took many, many years later to find out who were the investors that actually made money in this sector and who were chasing the promise.
How much do you think has really changed in the last 10 years? Are we actually going to be seeing even bigger acquisitions and higher valuations on tech companies?
Well, the overall size of acquisitions is broadly in proportion to the size of the economy. And right now, we're at a very late and mature stage of an acquisition cycle. I think, if anything, we're probably going to see some correction, some consolidation, some stabilization in the first half of the next decade. And in order for much, much larger acquisitions and valuations when we do this show in 2030, we're really going to need to see new technologies and new things, all of which are actually profitable, that we're not seeing today. So really, when you talk about how much has changed in the last 10 years, we've been seeing lots of new solutions that just simply didn't exist 10 years ago or 20 years ago. Don't forget, 10 years ago, I was still on my first iPhone, and several companies that I'd worked with still had keyboards on their phone. And you think of how many of the technologies and acquisitions we're dealing with now have to do with mobile apps and the fact that our world is different because of the device in our pocket. That is one of the things that will be harder for us to predict over the next 10 years as well.
And does this ring any bells in terms of how things were in the previous century, the late 1999s, during the tech boom?
Well, it certainly seems to rhyme. It certainly reminds us a lot. So as I mentioned earlier, not only do I remember 2010 well, I do remember late 99, 2000 well. The biggest difference by far is that at that time, many of the dot-com companies were not making money. And now, if you want to choose large tech companies that are making money, you've got plenty of choices. I mean, Google is actually a very profitable company. Amazon, even though it trades at very high valuations, is actually profitable. You do have other companies like Tesla, for example, which are trading at ridiculously high multiples to sales, and they're not making money. But at least now you have choice, and you're seeing technologies that are actually making money. But in terms of valuations being stretched, yes, that definitely rhymes with 1999.
And disruption seems to be the key buzzword over the last decade, and something that I guess many startups are kind of born to do. Are disruptive tech startups really sustainable in the long run? Because you talked about how in the dot-com era, a lot of the tech companies were not profitable. There are still many tech startups in this decade who look to disrupt traditional businesses aren't actually profitable just yet.
Well, disruption for its own sake is not necessarily a good thing. I mean, what disruption should mean is you are doing something better, faster, and cheaper than the incumbent. I mean, then the classic case of disruption I often think of is the automatic elevator. Don't forget, when elevators first came in, they required a human operator to go in and operate the elevator, close the door, make sure everyone's safe, go up, stop it at the right level, and bring it out. Someone who is able to develop a device where you could simply push a button and it would take you to the floor you wanted, that was disruptive because it meant you no longer needed to hire an elevator operator, which required a wage, required sick days, took space in an elevator, and took up energy. And the same exact thing with many things we do. I mean, here in Hong Kong, we still stand in line and we write paper checks. I mean, some of the disruption we would love to see is from a fintech that lets us do low-cost payments of some of our commercial bills. And it doesn't have to be necessarily super high-tech, but in order for it to be sustainable, the provider has to be profitable. And the challenge I think you have with a lot of disruptors is they will burn money like crazy when it comes to just showing how disruptive they are and gaining market share. The ones that are sustainable are the ones that actually are able to start turning a profit.
And what about like the legislation side? Like, do you think it's playing a catch-up game as fast enough as it should be?
Well, it's it can be a bit of a double-edged sword because on one hand, you've seen the regulations change anyway just with changing social sentiment. I mean, the idea that we now need to disclose fees that are in mutual funds. If you already had a big legacy business and a fixed way of doing things, it might be much harder for you to change than a newer smaller, more nimble startup. On the other hand, you do see certain regulations that almost seem in place to keep technology from moving forward. The ancient example here were rules on how trains had to be operated. Back to the railroad example, they used to require three people operating every single train car. And of course, as trains got more and more efficient, you no longer needed three people, but those rules stayed there. And that is an example of why there are so few people riding trains in the United States now. Same exact thing is in some countries, banks are required, for example, to have large bank branches. And in other countries, they're not. The countries which require them to have large bank branches, you're going to see less fintech innovation than in areas where those barriers to entry are not so high.
I'm speaking to Tariq Dennison from GFM Asset Management about startups' valuation over the last decade as part of our Decade in Review special. We'll continue in just a moment. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Balanced Frank Medium. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back. My name is Jeff Sandhu, and today's Decade in Review special, I have Tariq Dennison from GFM Asset Management in Hong Kong discussing startup valuations. And earlier on, we talked about the changes over the last 10 years and if there were any similarities of such explosive growth in previous decades. Tariq, just before the break, we spoke on how disruptive companies are operating. And with the increase of privacy awareness and data protection, what's your take on this? Do you think this would hamper the growth of tech startups and their valuation, especially when there's more eyes on them and what they do with our data?
Well, not directly, because remember the thing with data privacy, it's a two-edged sword. Any of us who are on Facebook choose to be on Facebook and choose to give Facebook information in exchange for certain things. Every single one of those is a contract. And even in the past few years, we've seen that contract getting more and more streamlined. I know some people who will not get on Facebook because they're concerned with data privacy. And there are others like myself who I don't mind giving certain data that I control to Facebook. And I recognize that I'm giving that in exchange for something. I think so long as we understand what data is there, what we're giving up and what we get in return, that lets both those of us as consumers make proper decisions and those of us investing in the sector make proper valuations for what that data is worth.
Mm. What do you think we've learned over the last decade from the tech sector?
Well, I don't think the lessons are really out yet, because I think right now we still see several tech companies whose valuations really haven't been justified. I mean, another example I'd give of many IPOs you want to talk about would be, say, Zoom Communications. Mm. Well, they provide a service which is very similar to many other services in the same space, and I don't see how they're able to justify their valuation. It almost seems like the initial lesson was, if you have technology in your business plan in some way, you can get a much higher valuation than you don't, whether or not it makes sense. The lesson that we'd only started seeing recently with WeWork was that seemed to almost have no limit until finally a few investors said no thanks when they finally read the prospectus. And you saw how the valuation on WeWork went from, around $50 billion to around $8 billion. That's probably going to be one of the major signs that certain things had turned by this point. Now, again, you're talking about cases like WeWork, which really was a real estate company pretending to be a technology company. In other cases where you have real technologies that are not only solving real problems, but doing it better, faster, cheaper, and being profitable along the way, those are the ones who I think we all wish we would have invested in 5 years from now. Mm.
Do you think the IPO route then is still something that startups would want to pursue? Because we've seen the rise of many different, I guess, areas for them to raise funds with the alternative side of raising funds, whether it's the equity crowdfunding model or crowdsourcing. Is IPO still a route that many of these kind of disruptive startups would want to take?
Well, I think it should be. I can explain a little bit about why it hasn't been and why that bothers me as a public market investor. I mean, one thing that is different about 1999 is back then IPO was the clear exit route. Getting into the public markets was where most of the investors, whether mutual funds, hedge funds, individual retail investors, would have wanted to pay a fair price for whatever a company might be. But in the past 5 years, we've seen many companies not even bother with the private markets. They've stayed private, and they've done their fifth, sixth, seventh funding round all in the private markets. They've stayed private for longer, or sometimes they've gotten acquired and never gone the IPO route as well. I think the problem with that is that it never opens itself to public scrutiny. When you're dealing with private deals, you have selected vetting of financials, selected revelation of financials. There's no standard place where you have to file 2 to 4 times a year. What are your audited financial statements, audited earnings, and let everyone in the public go compete and set a proper price. So even though I believe that IPOs should be the way that technologies ultimately go to public markets, that's not the way things have been going in the past. I think if we start seeing a correction in the private equity space and private equity investors start getting much more selective on what they invest in, that will make the IPO route more appealing again.
What about other sectors? Do you think there's some learnings that other sectors or other industry verticals could take from how the tech has been in the last decade?
Well, one thing I think it's important to be clear here is that tech is not really its own sector anymore. I mean, back in 99, we would have thought so. But like if you talk about Amazon, is Amazon a tech company or are they a retail company or are they an internet services company? Is Google a tech company or is it an advertising company that just uses technology to be more efficient? So I think the short answer is not thinking of tech as a sector at all, but thinking of all of these different businesses as businesses and how are they doing what they do better, faster, and cheaper in whatever sector they happen to be operating in.
What's the, on your side, what are you looking out in terms of emerging sectors as we move into the year 2020?
Well, I'm not looking just at year 2020. I'm actually looking ahead at 2030. I'm trying to look over the next decade. And what I'm seeing are large demographic trends. I'm looking at the fact that every year the world, not just the developed world, but all of our countries are getting older. So sectors like elder care, senior living, those are all things that we're going to have to pay more and more attention to. If you look at countries like Japan, Germany, or Italy, one of the reasons they've invested so much in just vending machines and robots is the fact that they have a lack of younger workers. Now, in some countries with young populations, that may not be so pressing, but that's going to be an issue that we will be talking about 10 years from now, even in countries whose populations now look quite healthy. So pretty much in any area where I see clerical, somewhat unskilled work that has the potential to be automated, those are areas where I think there's still a lot of cleanup work to be done over the next few years.
Tariq, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeff.
And that was Tariq Dennison, the wealth manager at GFM Asset Management in Hong Kong, on our second Decade in Review special that took a look into startups valuation. If you missed any parts of this conversation or any parts of our Decade in Review special, you can download the podcast now available on the BFM website, the BFM app, or on Spotify. My name is Jeff Sandhu, and this has been Tech Talk on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.